Canto 17 has quite a distinctive feel. It's a very descriptive canto, one that requires our imagination as much as following what's going on. Dante doesn't actually speak at all in this canto. It's very much focused on Virgil and what they see as it unfolds and what they experience too. And I think this is really significant. It's partly because it's a transitional canto. They're on the edge of descending into the deepest pit of hell. And so it's moving us in the narrative towards a new kind of stage, a new phase of perception. But it's doing so to elicit something from us as readers. It's not just telling us, it's showing us things in order that we are asked really to feel our way into what's going on, to experience it in some measure too, rather than just be told. And I think this must be part of the reason why, at the end of Canto 16, Dante makes this hugely strong claim, saying that everything that he sees is true and he swears by the Divine Comedy. We will see it too, it's almost saying. We'll see the truth of it too if we're able to enter into this in-between space that's not just about being told, but is imaginatively entering into what's being described, so we kind of feel it rising up within ourselves as well. So that's by way of introduction. It opens very directly with Virgil describing the appearance of the monster that's being conjured up out of the deep by Virgil throwing Dante's cord over the edge. You remember that Dante gives up his cord, he becomes a little less defended, I think this means. Virgil throws this over the edge, and now swimming up from the depths, the air is if it's like water. It's a very mysterious kind of description. Appears the monster, and Virgil names it. He sees it straight away for what it is. He says, "This is the beast that flattens mountains, that breaks down walls, that's the horror of humankind." He's describing fraud, and I think fraud not just meant in the small way of conning people, of deceiving people. But fraud meant in the biggest possible way, where everything in creation is perverted and turned for human ends in an isolated, selfish, completely disconnected from what's good, and what's loving and what's kind. It's the full-on narcissism that I was wondering, can help us understand this third stage of hell that we're now about to enter. That meant in the technical sense of the person who is so lost, they in a way don't even really know that others exist, and they can't feel the love of others, and so are locked and trapped into a state of mind that constantly turns in on itself. It's the struggle to love yourself, to be able to get over yourself and see others, and so is this particularly desperate state. So Virgil names the monster right from the get-go. He's not named quite yet, but he's called Geryon. He's a monster brought in from ancient mythology, where he was a giant who lived in nature. And now Dante uses that sort of starting point to reimagine, to re-see Geryon now. And what we're shown in the canto is a creature made up of three parts. We're told that his head is like a charming human face, looks completely benign. And then we look a bit further along his body and we see that it's painted in rather alluring, beautiful colours. We're told it's like arabesques and fine designs, that Ariadne never wove a more beautiful textile. But this is an unsettling description because, of course, Ariadne was cursed by the gods because shared in this hubris, which we've already seen in the previous cantos, of someone who got seduced by their own capacity to make beautiful things, and so felt they could outshine the gods, became disconnected from the gods. So Geryon's back is this seductive part of himself, and sure enough, it leads to the sting in his tail, quite literally, which is described as like a scorpion sort of flipping around, waiting to poison you. And this is a very powerful allegory of what fraud is like, that it begins with a kind of seduction, promises the earth, but actually has this terrible sting in its tail. But before we continue with what's going to happen between Dante and Virgil and Geryon, there's a pause, because Dante notices that there's another group of souls right on the edge of this seventh round before the final plunge. And Virgil says to him, go and see who they are to complete your knowledge of this part of hell. We might say to fulfill his initiation, that has enabled him not just to see, you might say, objective states of mind, but through this direct knowledge, which the journey through hell, the descent, actually allows, to know how these states of mind do and don't relate to his own inner state, so that he's able to navigate his way through hell, but unlike all the souls he finds there, not get stuck, not get lost. So it's a pregnant phrase Virgil uses when he says to complete. It's to bring to completion, to, you might say, finish the lesson, in this sense of direct awareness, direct wisdom of all that he's encountered in hell. And so he steps out. Interestingly, we're told at this point that they've made a right turn again. They're not following the divine path through hell, you might say, which is following the leftward track. But this time, they only take 10 steps. It's really striking when you get these little details. It's part of the realism of the Inferno. But also, it's telling us that unlike the deviation which they made before, where they moved right for the whole canto, when they were in the circle of the so-called heretics, those who had followed their path so much so that they'd become disconnected from God, they only have to take a sort of small detour this time. It's got to be their detour so that they can encounter something inside themselves. But they're much more aligned with God, you might say now. I think this is one of these details that gives us a sense of how the descent is enabling them to change. So they make this small detour, and then Dante goes off to look at these souls who are right on the edge. He doesn't say anything. It's also striking that he goes off on his own, apart from Virgil. All these details are starting to conjure up for us the memory of Dis. Do you remember that was the last time that Virgil left Dante on his own, when Virgil went to encounter the demons that were packing the walls and the gates and the parapets of Dis. Dante was left on his own, terrified. Well, this time Dante is able to move on his own towards these other souls. Again, he's got more of a sense of himself, more awareness, more wisdom, enough to do so. And he says that he doesn't recognise any of these souls. You know, they're so disfigured by whatever their state of mind is that they're not recognisable at all. They're described as sitting on the ground. Dante does know that each of them is wearing a great pouch full of money, a purse, and each has a heraldic emblem upon it. You know, a white goose on a blue background, other animals on coloured backgrounds. And the souls are sitting static, staring at their purses. And this shows us what the final sin of this round is. You know, if someone like Bruno Latini's problem had been that his fame and his success in his art had ultimately disconnected him from God, and then we'd seen how Rustichi and the other fellows, the other noble fellows that Dante had just encountered, their kind of obsession with their own fame had disconnected from them from God. Well, now we meet the individuals whose obsessions with money straight up, you know, not even wanting to make anything, not even wanting to achieve anything, just money, pure and simple, has so gripped them in their souls that they're now stuck, sat, staring at their purses and, you know, perverting even the heraldry, even the nobility, even the virtue they might have in so doing. One of the commentators makes this very profound remark, I think, that these usurers are like unmoved movers. You know, usury in life of itself doesn't achieve anything, but what it does is it draws in people either out of need or out of greed. And that's how it creates its movement in the world. That's how it makes new worlds, you might say, out of this borrowing and lending. And this, of course, is a horrible kind of diminution, even perversion, of God, who in Aristotle is described as the unmoved mover. But God in Aristotle is the unmoved mover because in Dante's view, God showers gifts, God just gives. And it's that love and showering and delight that causes the whole universe to move, that causes people to move towards God. So again, it's another reflection of why usury is so very high risk, particularly when you think about it for us, whose now whole world really is founded upon usury. It's not just that it creates unnatural worlds that lose touch with the pulse of life. You know, in part for the good, that's part of its entrapment. But also, now we're learning that its motion, what causes people to gravitate more and more around it, is not actually love, is not actually gift, but it's this complex mix of need and greed. It's not a simple thing to untangle. In a way, that's partly why Dante must encounter it, must see it for what it is in the round, and only then can he learn. You know, maybe we can begin to learn a little bit about how to navigate a way through this quality, this habit, this way now that our world is so profoundly shaped. One of the usurers does speak out. He's called Reginaldo. We do know something about him. In particular, we know that his son was so horrified by his father's exploitation of people that he built a chapel in penance, which actually became a chapel where Giotto painted some of his best known frescoes and has actually been called one of the most beautiful spaces, one of the most beautiful interiors in the whole of Christendom. You know, so there's a sort of vague echo there that if you do see usury for what it is, then something beautiful can perhaps come out of it in the end. But that doesn't happen here. Dante just sees these souls in their stuckness, in their distress. He describes them as being like dogs infested with fleas, and they're just constantly sort of biting and scratching and hitting themselves to try and ease their discomfort. And that is their trapped state of mind. You know, they can't co-create, and they can only self-isolate. And that is the profundity of this sin. As if to emphasise that, just as Dante turns round to return to Virgil, Reginaldo's tongue is said, like, flips out of his mouth like an ox's tongue. This is the sort of the bestial disfiguring that they've become. But they're left. Dante hasn't had a conversation with them. He returns to Virgil, sensing that he must get back there in time. And what we see now is Virgil sort of in full command. We're told that he's already on the strong back of Geryon. It's a very, very different scene from Dis, you know, where Virgil had been stymied and they'd had to wait, both of them in fear and trembling, for the great angel of the Lord to appear and kind of rescue them with a power that they didn't understand. Well, now Virgil has seen things, and drawing on his own wisdom, his own capacities, he's able to command Gerilon, it's very striking that he speaks to Gerilon kindly throughout the canto. He asks Gerilon, for example, to let them ride on his back and so descend into the deeper reaches of hell. When they get going, he says to Gerilon, remember you've got a living soul on your back and move slowly. And the description of them descending into the depths is described like a great navigator controlling a boat. We're told that Gerilon backs off from the edge, he turns around, and then he descends in great circles. Dante is terrified during this descent. He clutches ever more tightly. He buries his face in Gerilon's back. When he does venture to look down, he just sees the walls of hell closing in. He hears screams. He sees flames. It terrifies him all the more. But it contrasts with Virgil's composure and his control of Gerilon as they move down. And, you know, it raises the question of what Virgil has learned and just highlights the fact that Virgil too is learning through this, his second descent into hell. In parenthesis, I think this is as much about Virgil's own transformation as it is Dante's, that often plays second fiddle to Dante's illumination. But in this canto, we get a chance to contemplate it all the more. I think what Virgil has learnt is to see through fraud, see through all that Gerilon stands for, and to recognise that this is actually more powerful than all the fraudulent deception, the bullying behaviour, the terror, the fear that this kind of human being, this kind of soul can inflict upon others. It's a quiet steadiness that holds on to what's good and true, even when everything around seems to be full of poison and sin. That now Virgil is able to command in himself. And Gerilon recognises that. You know, the bully at the end of the day can see when the person they're trying to control, actually, whatever they do to them, and they may do terrible things to them, but whatever do they do to them, they haven't got their victim really under their control. They can always hold on to a pure and true part of themselves. You know, it's a bit like when you read of, I know, victims of the worst atrocity, like people being marched off to the camps during the Holocaust in the Second World War. And what's also remembered alongside the horror are these extraordinary tales where people kept their humanity. You know, they turned to the chambers so that someone else might be free. They knelt down and helped someone, even though the guard was about to strike them, if not kill them. It's that quality that I think Virgil has discovered inside himself now. And so he's able to face down Gerilon and ask him to carry Dante and himself down to the deeper reaches of hell. Another reflection on this might be like, it's a bit like the hero's journey, where the hero steps out in their own kind of naivety, and they make their mistakes, they get beaten, like Virgil was before the gates of Dis. But they keep at it, and they learn from their mistakes, they learn from the descent, and it becomes an ascent, so that, as it were, they can bring back not just a souvenir from their travels, but the real treasure itself, and pass that on, which is what Virgil is doing in this canto to Dante. I think this is also echoed in the imagery that comes towards the end of the canto when they do climb off Gerilon's back, because Gerilon is very strikingly said to have shot off at that moment like an arrow, having moved so beautifully and steadily in their descent. And I think that this is Gerilon being furious. Dante the poet says that he's furious like the falcon that hasn't managed to capture its prey. And I wonder whether the imagery of falconry is invoked because, you know, the falcon is hooded before his flight. He's not allowed to just behave from his own nature but without sight, is controlled by the falconer. And Virgil's a bit like the falconer here, because he can see and the falcon can't. He can control this monstrous bird in its artificial flight. I'd even go so far as to wonder whether Virgil in this canto is a bit like Christ before Pilate. You know, Pilate seeming having all the power, and yet Christ in his silence asking what truth really is, controls Pilate, even as Christ is sent to his own death, descends into hell itself as well. Virgil has a kind of, not direct parallel, but an echo of this quality. There's something quite Christ-like about Virgil in this canto, which I think is going to be important further down the line. If that is something about Virgil, in a way, the one pole of this canto, the pole that sees, that understands, that can draw on its own wisdom, that can overcome fear with clarity of sight. Dante, the pilgrim in this canto, doesn't exhibit those qualities. He doesn't cry and faint as he had earlier in hell, but he doesn't speak. And he stresses his fear many, many times as they climb onto Geryon's back and move off in this almost sort of dance-like way. Dante himself is left in sort of full terror. And he remembers two mythical figures. He remembers Phaeton, the son of the god who steered the sun across the sky and fell because he burnt everything. And he remembers too Icarus, the son of Daedalus, whose wings, held together by wax, again moved too close to the sun and melted and fell. Dante gives really significant words to Daedalus as he recalls these mythical figures and their fall, their horror, their fear, as they felt themselves tumbling. And when he says Daedalus called out to his son, "Your path is wrong." Now it's really significant because Dante, the pilgrim at this moment, is not sure whether their path is right or wrong. But in a way, what comes to his mind, what comes to his imagination, these stories about the old mythical figures that ascended too quickly, might give him some comfort, because of course he's not ascending too quickly. He's actually descending rather carefully. And so he is actually following the right path, encountering things within himself, in order that he too might be able to see, as Virgil seems to be able to see so clearly. But in his horror of the descent, he doesn't remember that right now. But I think that's what Dante, the poet, is indicating to us. Again, the descent is actually, strangely, the right path when it grows and awakens something inside you. They reach the bottom of their descent, where right by the jagged cliffs, Geryon lets them off his back and then shoots off like an arrow. And it leaves you kind of wondering right at the end what this canto has really been about. Again, I think it's about a contrast between, on the one hand, Virgil's clarity, Virgil's wisdom that he's now gained having made his mistakes before the walls of Dis. And Dante's still learning that, you know, he's been able to step out a little bit, take these 10 steps. He's learned a lot from the older rounds of hell. But now as they enter the 8th round, he's got a whole new set of insights to learn, new souls to see, new states of mind to conjure with and reflect upon in himself. And with its invitation ourselves to imagine the truth of this canto, you know, with its descriptions that leave a lot of questions at one level, but a lot of space for discovery for us as readers, I think we're sort of invited to move in between Virgil and Dante in some way, you know, to wonder what's going on, to reflect on our own fear, you know, maybe given the prevalence of usury even in our own world, and how we try to find a way between this mix of good and ill, so that we become co-creators with the divine, not lost from the divine, as clearly can so easily happen. And so this canto is not just a transitional canto in terms of the journey, but might be one that impacts upon us, that becomes a kind of transitional canto for us, readying us as readers for even worse terrors and horrors that are now about to unfold before us. You might say that's inviting us to learn a kind of fourfold vision, to use Blake's expression. This is the vision where you can hold on to what you do know, but also what you don't know. You can hold on to the fear, but also know that thin but constant light of love. You can see the outer form of things, you know, much like Gerulon the monster with his strange threefold shape, but also see the inner truth of that, and so speak and command and find the way as Virgil has done, holding on to the kind of inner wisdom and not just being overwhelmed by the outer sight. That's this kind of multi-dimensional sight, which I think this canto is powerfully pointing towards. That said, we must stay with Dante the Pilgrim and remember that he felt fear in this canto. The edginess was stressed a lot in this canto. The outer edginess of Gerulon the monster clutching with his paws to the edge of the cliff while his tail floated in free space. The edginess of this final group of usurers who are right on the cliff face before the final plunge into hell. And stay with that inner transitional state then as well, knowing something a bit more now, but being prepared to stay undefended and open to what might come further as Dante and Virgil leave Gerulon the monster, who shoots off. They're in a terrible place again, where there's edgy cliffs, where there's flame, and where there's more souls screaming out in distress.